Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to another newly recorded episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Mark Hertzgard, veteran journalist and author, and the investigative editor of The Nation, about his recent Nation cover story, How Big Wireless Made Us Think That Cell Phones Are Safe. Now, before I bring him in, after a three-year hiatus with the election of Donald Trump, I couldn't resist exploring the path forward in new interviews, and this is the 27th such interview, about one every other week since then. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on her book No Is Not Enough, David K. Johnson a couple of times on the daily dirty work of the Trump administration. And the show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn on the weekend, Saturday and Sunday. And podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on iTunes, Podomatic.com, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net. Let me offer you a few websites for information on how to participate in resistance to the Trump agenda and work toward the healthy and just future we all need. And you can email me at TEMcNally, TEMCNALLY, at Mac.com if you want more info of this sort. IndivisibleGuide.com, IndivisibleGuideOneWord.com, probably the largest network of folks newly activated by the Trump administration. OurRevolution.com, an organization that grew out of the Bernie Sanders campaign. That's OurRevolutionOneWord.com. MoveOn.org. MoveOn's been around, since the middle of the Clinton administration, but they've gotten more tightly tied with grassroots action to supplement their digital activism. CourageCampaign.org, that's one word, Courage Campaign, which is sort of like Move On in California. Been heavily digital, but now linking more closely to the grassroots. And two that are sort of specific. One is 5Calls, that's the number 5 and the word calls, 5Calls.org, which will tell you some of the most relevant and timely calls you can make to your representatives, and TownHallProject.com, which will tell you when your local representatives are going to be appearing locally, and you can let them know how you feel and what you want them to do as your representatives. Now to today's guest. I've been narrowing my focus a bit in these new interviews. More often, they've been overtly political or focused on political change, often on a national scale and so on. But as soon as I saw this story by Mark Hertzgard at The Nation Online, How Big Wireless Made Us Think That Cell Phones Are Safe, I wanted to talk with him about it. And I'm going to give you three reasons. First, it's an example of unethical abuse of science and the truth by power and wealth. And that is all too prevalent and predates Trump's trip down the escalator into the White House. Like so many others, this story reminds us that Trump is a symptom, not a cause. Second, the truth about cell phone safety matters to all of us. 95 out of every 100 American adults own a cell phone today. And worldwide, 3 out of 4 adults now have cell phone access, 3 out of 4 globally. And the wireless industry is one of the fastest growing on Earth, raking in annual sales of $440 billion in 2016. And third, Mark Hertzgard covers a lot of other beats. His books reflect that, from press and the White House in On Bended Knee, to environmental challenges and climate change in Earth Odyssey and Hot. His first book was about nuclear issues, and his latest article in The Nation is an interview with Daniel Ellsberg about the U.S. policy to launch a first-strike nuclear attack. Mark Hertzgard is a veteran journalist and author, and the investigative editor of The Nation. His books include the highly acclaimed study of the media during the Reagan years on Bended Knee, as well as A Day in the Life, The Music and Artistry of the Beatles, kind of a divergence there, but one that means a lot to Mark, Earth Odyssey, Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth, and Bravehearts, Whistleblowing in the Age of Snowden. Welcome, Mark Hertzgard, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Tuesday, April 24th, 2018. Welcome, Mark.
Always good to be here, Terrence. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So I often ask folks to talk a little bit at first about their path to the work they do so we get a sense of the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. One thing, a recent thing, you were for years the environmental correspondent at The Nation, and now your title is investigative editor. What does that change mean for you? And if you can tie it kind of to your path and your career's work, do so.
Actually, I remain the environment correspondent as well as the editor
okay.
at the Nation magazine. So it's more of an additional responsibility than a shift. And both of those have actually been concerns and interests of mine since the very start of my career. As you mentioned, my first book was a book called Nuclear Inc., which was an investigative book on the nuclear power industry. And I've always felt that the environment and nuclear issues are the big issues, because if we don't get them right, we're not going to be here to get poverty right or racism right or you name it down the list. And so I've always been interested in those issues. And the investigative approach has always seemed to me to be one of the most important that a public intellectual can engage in, because essentially, I'm interested in power and how power works and how power is too often used to impose unjust agendas on the common good. And generally, however, at least in a democracy, that has to be hidden. That kind of working of power has to be hidden, or it wouldn't be tolerated. And so one of the roles of the investigative journalist is to pierce the veil of that concealment and to try and bring forward what is really going on in the halls of power that you don't hear about in the press releases. And so I was very glad to be offered the investigative editor position at The Nation magazine. And I'll just point out that that was before Trump was elected. You know, there's been a lot of news organizations that have kind of jumped on the investigative bandwagon after Trump's election, and I'm very glad to see that. It's long overdue. But I want to just give a shout-out to the editor-in-chief at The Nation magazine, Katrina Vandenhoevel, who saw this coming, saw the need for more investigative work before the November 2016 election, and asked me if I'd take it on, and I've been very happy to do so. And we've done a lot of, I think, really strong investigative pieces in this last year or so, but none of them, I think, have had quite the response or the impact of this latest one that I co-published with Mark Dowie, How Big Wireless Made Us Think That Cell Phones Are Safe.
And before we jump into that one, when you point out that the way you've seen it and you think the way it works is that the investigative journalist plays, an incredibly important role. How does that role and the financing of that role look nowadays when newspapers are in trouble and aggregators on the internet are in the ascension?
Yes. I would actually put a longer time window on this, Terrence. I think that investigative reporting has been in trouble in this country really since the 1980s and during the Reagan years when I wrote my book on Bended Knee. Investigative journalism was beginning to go out of favor inside the corporate suites and the executive offices that were having, beginning in the 1980s, were beginning to have more and more control over what news operations were doing or not doing. And part of that was ideological. Part of that was just a desire not to get on the wrong side of the Reagan administration. But a lot of it was commercially driven. There's a very famous story from inside of CBS where one top executive, a man named Howard Stringer, who later went on to be a big poobah in running TV and became the head of Sony. But at this point, he was still in the news division, and he was asking these investigative reporters, why do I employ you? You guys, you come in with some big idea about some investigation you want to do. You then go disappear for 6 months. I don't see you. You don't produce anything. 6 months later, you come back, and you throw all this junk on my desk that is only going to get me a lot of phone calls from people who don't like it. And why am I doing this? And that story kind of summarizes the tension between what I would call real reporters who feel an obligation to the public to get in there and find out what's going on behind closed doors, and especially the closed doors of the powerful institutions in government, in business, and elsewhere that shape so much of our lives. That tension between the journalists on the one hand and then the executives on the other hand, who, let's face it, they are part of the dominant political and economic class in this country. And I think that that point of view from the business side gained ascendance starting in the 1980s and really accelerated through the 90s and into the aughts of this new century. So it's not just the internet that is driving down investigative reporting, although it hasn't helped, surely. It's this larger ideological shift within the media, which in turn is driven by the increasing corporate control over the media and the government's basically drawing back from any kind of public service obligation in the media. And that started under Reagan, where there was no longer a requirement that TV and radio stations adhere to the fairness doctrine or do documentaries and serious news programs and investigative reports as part of their civic duty in exchange for being given, the licenses to operate television stations, which are fabulously profitable enterprises, but that are using the public airwaves. And that was always the essential bargain that was made between the government and the big broadcasters was, we'll give you broadcasters access to the public airwaves, and you can make, buckets of money with your entertainment and sports programming. And in return for that privilege, we do demand that you give the public news and current affairs programming, including investigative reporting. And that social compact held up until the 1980s, when the Reagan administration basically dismantled it. So what we're seeing today is the long-term evolution and diminishment of the investigative reporting function that used to be there. And the election of Trump finally has awakened some of the news outlets to say, hey, we've got to do more investigative. But if you look closely, Terrence, most of the new investigative work is being funded by philanthropy.
Yeah, I wanted to mention I interviewed Chuck Lewis a few weeks ago of the, who started three different investigative reporting nonprofits. And so if people want to go into that issue in depth, go to my site or iTunes and look up the interview with Charles Lewis of the Center for Public Integrity and the Consortium of Investigative Journalists and so on.
And a writer for The Nation magazine, I might add.
That's right.
An interesting piece.
That's right.
For us, right after Trump was elected.
Yep.
Saying, does investigative reporting still matter? Does truth still matter?
Yep.
Yes, it does. But we really do rely on the public to make it matter, so that when our stories come out, make sure you pass them around, bring them to the attention of your elected officials, and by the way, subscribe, help pay for journalism. Part of the reason we got Trump is because people, we did not have, as a populace, there was not good reporting on Trump before he was elected. And I think that that is partly because too many people today, I'm sorry if I sound like a school here, but too many people today think that news should be free. You shouldn't have to pay for news, it should just come free on your cell phone. Well, you know what they say about what you pay for in life, if you pay nothing for it, it's probably worth nothing.
That's right.
And I think that's what happened with a lot of the media coverage and the public awareness going into November 2016, and now we're paying the price.
Absolutely. And as you were saying about the as the networks change their tune, starting with the Reagan years and so on, then the Trump was a cash cow to them. And their responsibility to the public was left in the dust during the campaign until it was too late.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So let's go to the Nation investigation that I mentioned. How Big Wireless Made Us Think That Cell Phones Are Safe. How did this story come about? Because I noticed you released the story right as a big toxicological review came out. How long ago did you start working on this, and how does a story like this happen?
Sure, yeah, we released it on March 29th, and just the night before, the U.S. National Toxicology Program, which is part of the National Institutes of Health, had their major $25 million study of cell phone radiation, which they had completed, underwent peer review. And the peer review scientists actually upgraded the confidence levels of the study and concluded that there was, quote-unquote, clear evidence that cell phone radiation can cause cancer. And so that was kind of serendipity. I mean, we knew that that report was coming out. We didn't know it would be coming out quite that closely to our release. And it's very interesting, speaking of the media here, Terrence, that no one, there has not been a single major news outlet in the United States, aside from The Nation, that has published a story about that National Toxicology Program study, finding that there's clear evidence that cell phones cause cancer.
I mean, I learned that when I was preparing for the show, and of course I went online looking for, you know, what have other people said about this, and there wasn't much there. That's, I mean, that must even surprise you.
You know, after a lifetime and as an American journalist, the press does still, I wouldn't say surprise me, but it does still disappoint me. I mean, this cell phone technology is one of the ascendant critical technologies of our time. It is, cell phones are, you know, a device that everyone now has, most of us are addicted to, and there have been questions raised about their safety for a long time. So how do major news organizations ignore the biggest study to come out of the United States government about cell phone radiation? How do they ignore it entirely?
Yeah, and
I really don't get it.
And the funny thing to me is that it seems like it's even in the wherever the decisions are being made, there must be an argument, because a study like that would be hot news. They would get viewers, they would get readers, they would get clicks. But that must be overweighed by the fact that it's not hot news they want to talk about. What led you to get into this story in the first place?
I guess I have always been a little suspicious of cell phones. And it did not make intuitive sense to me that you could have a phone up to the side of your head and that the phone calls were traveling via radiation, via radio waves, to an antenna right there by your brain, and that there wouldn't be any danger. But I didn't, you know, look into it carefully. And then a few years ago, I noticed that the World Health Organization had decided that cell phone radiation was a, quote-unquote, possible human carcinogen. Mind you, I saw that news story in the BBC. It wasn't reported in the United States. But I read the BBC religiously, and I thought, well, that's interesting. And then just my nose, my investigative reporter's nose told me there's something here. And so along with investigative reporter Mark Dowie, we started to look, and sure enough, there was something there. And in particular, what's striking to me is that the wireless industry has been lying about the potential dangers of cell phones for many years, and it has been doing so by borrowing from the very same PR playbook that Big Tobacco pioneered to lie about cigarettes, and that then Big Oil perfected to lie about climate change. And for me personally, that was kind of the connection, because I had done some of the first reporting on how Big Oil had lied about climate change, and in particular, the tobacco connection. I did a piece for Vanity Fair magazine about 10 years ago. That was the first investigative expose to show that Big Oil was using the same tactics and literally the same scientists who had lied about tobacco and cigarettes. And so I knew that general approach, on the part of corporations. And I thought, I wonder if the wireless industry is doing the same thing. And that, I think, is what's important about our expose in The Nation magazine, is that we show that not only has AT&T and the other big wireless companies, not only are they using the very same PR playbook that Big Tobacco and Big Oil did to lie about their products, but they were told, the wireless companies, just like Big Tobacco and Big Oil, were told 20 years ago by their own scientists, they were told privately, your product is dangerous, and in particular, it's dangerous to children.
Mm-hmm.
And what did the corporations do with that knowledge? They kept it to themselves. They did not tell the rest of the world. In fact, quite the opposite. They told the rest of the world there was no reason to worry, and all those people who are telling you that there are reasons to worry, they're quacks, they're nuts, they have no science behind them, et cetera, et cetera. So it's the very same agenda by the very same types of people, driven by the very same imperatives, which is that you put corporate profit over people's health.
Yeah, and that eventually, in all of these cases, eventually the truth comes out, but you buy yourself 10 years, 15 years of continued profits by doing business as usual. In the case of Big Oil, they've already invested in all these reserves, right? And so it gives them this, as long as they can sow confusion, and obviously they've never had a champion like the Trump administration, they can continue to reap the profits that they were planning on. Let me jump to one thing right now, which is that when I look at the title of your article, it seems, carefully chosen. In other words, the title does not scream, throw down your cell phone, it's going to give you cancer. The title says, this is an investigation of how the truth of the risk has been kept from you. How safe, how dangerous, what is the latest analysis of that?
You're correct. We chose those words carefully, and we specify in the article that we are not trying to litigate in this article the science, whether these products are safe or not. That really is for scientists to do. What we're showing to you is how the industry has essentially lied to you about what the risks really are, as you put it. So that said, we nevertheless did have to look at what the sort of the body of scientific literature showed, and that was very interesting. If you look at the database of roughly 200 studies of the potential health effects of cell phone radiation that is maintained by the U.S. government's National Institutes of Health, we looked at that, or I should say we looked at the analysis of that done by various specialists, and in particular a man named Henry Lai, who is a professor emeritus of bioengineering at the University of Washington in Seattle. And if you look at those 200 studies, the vast majority of them do find that there are potential health risks, in particular of three sorts: cancers, genetic damage, and potential miscarriages and so forth for pregnant women. It's not definitive. The science still does have to play out quite a bit. But there is abundant and growing evidence that cell phone radiation does cause, or can, I should say, cause cancer, does cause genetic damage, etc. So, and then if you peel the onion back one more layer, Henry Lai looked at how the science changes if you categorize it according to who paid for the scientific studies.
Excellent.
So when it's an independent funded study, that is a study that's funded by, say, a university or a government or some kind of public agency like the World Health Organization, those studies are 2.5 times more likely to find a health effect of cell phone radiation than an industry-funded study. And this gets to the core of the industry strategy. The industry does not have to win the scientific argument. They just have to keep the scientific argument going and create the appearance of scientific uncertainty in the public mind. And the way they do that, one of the ways they do that, is to fund their own studies, which, surprise, surprise, find that there's not much reason to worry.
Now, let me, something which I know happens in a lot of the health field is that, and I know that it's controversial, and there may be changes happening in the field of research, but if you fund a study and the study is not producing the results you want, one simple thing to do is never publish it. Did you run into that?
That is certainly true, and that's an allegation that was made against some of these studies that were commissioned by the industry. But no, we didn't find a lot of instances of that. That's not to say that they don't exist, but we sort of felt that the information that we did find was certainly damning enough.
Yeah, sure. So again, when you say that there is risk and the studies, the statistic that I think is most powerful is, you know, the funder determines the outcome of the study, which is kind of wild. And you say it's not conclusive. They've been around a long time. We're talking about 20 plus years, 30 plus years.
30 years now.
Yeah, what is it that, and it would seem to me you could have longitudinal studies at that point. Why do you think there's no conclusion?
Well, part of it is just the nature of cancer. You know,
okay.
There's still not absolutely conclusive evidence that smoking gives you lung cancer. That's evidenced by the fact that there are still people who
mm-hmm.
smoke all their lives and don't get cancer,
mm-hmm.
right? You may even know somebody like that. And that fact is exactly what is used by tobacco companies to this day to say, no, you can't sue us for wrongful death. And they've gotten away with that because there are, you know, cancer is not an obvious thing where, like, if I take a hammer to your leg, I can
right.
and break your leg. That's very clearly cause and effect. With smoking cigarettes, you know, there's a lot of other things that go into whether an individual gets cancer. It has to do with your genetics. It has to do with your lifestyle, and it has to do with luck, I think, a number of things. What we can say is, and what the scientific studies try to do, is to say, okay, if you do activity X, smoking cigarettes, let's say, or, you know, using a cell phone for 10 hours a day, your risk of getting cancer is going to be X amount greater. And that is what the studies that the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, are finding, is that the tendency towards cancer or the tendency towards genetic breaks is higher if you are using cell phone radiation. So I think that there is still more clarity that needs to be done, partly because, and this may be getting down a little bit in the weeds, but partly because scientists have not understood the mechanisms, the biological mechanisms by which cell phone radiation would cause cancer. And this, too, has a parallel to tobacco. At first, and back in the 50s, scientists couldn't understand why cigarette smoking would, for example, cause lung cancer or heart disease, because they didn't have that biological knowledge yet. So they thought, oh, it can't be happening. Well, that was a major mistake. Of course it was happening. They just didn't understand the biology well enough yet. So all of these things play into this in terms of how much scientists know. But that's why at the end of our piece we say, look, you know, there's something called the precautionary principle.
Yep.
When you've got enough evidence and to show that there's reason to be concerned and the consequences of using a given technology are, you know, great enough, you should consider holding off on that technology until greater clarity is achieved through more research.
Right.
But that's not what industry wanted.
No. And by the way,
out into the marketplace.
We've talked about this before on the show over the years, but countries in Europe are much more likely to govern industries by the precautionary principle, which is if something is new and potentially harmful, let's wait till we know it's safe. The American industry, certainly in the realm of cancer, certainly in the realm of chemicals, is governed by the opposite approach, which is say innocent until proven guilty, you can go a long time and make a lot of money before something turns out to be proven unsafe. This is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Mark Hertzgard, veteran journalist, author of, is it 7 or 8 books now at this point?
Seven.
Working
on 8.
I know. And eight. I was surprised to see this article because I knew how hard you were working on 8. He's also the investigative editor of The Nation, and we're talking about his recent Nation cover story, How Big Wireless Made Us Think That Cell Phones Are Safe. So just to stay with this risk for and behavior modification for a second, what do these findings tell us about how we might want to alter our behavior?
Sure. I think, again, I just want to emphasize, I am not a physician, and people who really want that question answered should consult organizations that can give them proper medical attention, or proper medical advice, rather. I recommend, for example, the Environment Health Trust. They have a website that summarizes a lot of this information. That said, what I am told by people who are experts in this field, a lot of it's sort of just kind of common sense. Use a landline when you can. Minimize your use of cell phones. Most people don't, many people, I should say, don't even have landlines anymore.
That's right.
They've all gone to cell phones. That's dangerous. You want to minimize the amount of cell phone use. Do I have a cell phone? People ask, yes, I do. But I'm talking right now on a landline, and I use that landline as often as possible. And when you are using the cell phone, keep the calls short and use earbuds. Do not use the phone itself. And when the phone call is connecting, try to hold that phone far, at least arm's distance, away from you. That you'd be surprised how much difference that can make, because these particular radio waves that operate cell phones do not necessarily travel that far.
And what you're saying is
to reach your phone, but
they're at their peak. The waves are somehow at their
far
peak.
Far away from that.
And the waves are at their peak at that moment when it's connecting, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So that's the time when you really want it to have it be as far away from you as possible.
And
as I say, you know, keep it short.
Yeah. What about when we use smartphones for other purposes? Is there danger when we're staring at the screen all day? And now we're not talking about the dangers to what it does to our minds, but what it does to our brains.
Yeah, that's, again, one of these things where I would say you should talk to the people at Environment Health Trust about that. There's different, I've heard different opinions
okay.
about it. I'm not qualified to.
Okay.
What do we hear from
the American Pediatrics Association? What do they say?
Yeah, the American Pediatrics Association actually went after the Federal Communications Commission, which is the federal agency that supposedly regulates the cell phone industry, because the FCC's radiation safety levels are based on the assumption that the person using the phone is an adult male who weighs about 200 pounds. And the American Pediatrics Association, of course, their patients are children, and they pointed out that this was this 200-pound man was a misleading standard for as far as children. Children obviously are not only have smaller skulls, but their skulls are still growing and expanding, so they're more porous for radiation. And then there's the second fact that children, of course, because they're younger, figure to have a larger cumulative exposure over their lifespan. So the Pediatrics Association urged the FCC to adjust its radiation level recommendations, and the FCC did nothing about that, and this has been years now. So we use that in the article as an example of what a journalist with the Harvard Ethics Center, Norm Alster, said about the FCC, which is that it's a quote-unquote captured agent.
Mm-hmm.
That is, a federal public agency that is responsible for regulating an industry, but that, in fact, has been captured by that industry, and its decisions tend to be more in industry's favor than in the public's favor.
Mm-hmm. And as people may be aware, this is business as usual. And what we see with the Trump administration and the Scott Pruitts and the Ryan Zinks and so on, and Jerry Mulvaney at the Consumer Protection Agency, is we see that regulatory capture in on steroids in a way that we've never seen it before, but it has been going on. It's just business as usual. I want to share one thing with you and get your observation on it. When I interviewed Arlie Hochschild recently, right, about her book Strangers in Their Own Land, about the folks down in southern Louisiana, and what she found was that a lot of her research was, why do they hate the government when, in fact, it's oil corporations and chemical corporations that are killing them and their land and endangering them and so on? And she found that one of the reasons the folks felt that way was because of regulatory capture. They felt that, look, the especially the state agencies, but also the federal agencies, were not protecting us. So I've got to use oil in my car, maybe, but I hate paying taxes to someone who's not doing their job. I mean, I think there's an insidious, you know, there's the obvious problems with regulatory capture, and there's insidious ones as well that lead to cynicism and resignation.
I think they do lead to cynicism and resignation, and of course, those are increased by the general tenor of government bashing that, again, dates back to the Reagan era of the 1980s, but has become Republican Party gospel ever since, that nothing the government does can ever be right. It's always slipshod or corrupt, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that that is certainly a part of that. I don't find that, however, a very persuasive explanation for the belief system that Arlie Hochschild describes in her book on the part of those people down in Louisiana who don't want regulation. Because why? Because the regulation hasn't been strong enough in the past. I mean, I think that that's bending over backwards to give those folks the benefit of the doubt, position.
Yeah.
I think that position, frankly, has a lot more to do with what they're hearing from Fox News and the right-wing media echo chamber than any kind of a rational understanding of what government regulation really does.
So let's dig in a little bit into some of the story that your investigation unfolds. How long have we had suspicions about this type of radiation? And if you could, even a little bit of what kind of radiation are we talking about?
Yeah, what's interesting, and maybe is the original sin in this whole story, is that cell phones were allowed onto the U.S. consumer market in 1984 without government safety testing, without independent safety testing. The government just let the cell phones onto the market. And at that point, as some listeners may remember, those early cell phones were about the size of a large brick.
Yep.
You know, and people were saying, oh, nobody's ever going to buy this stuff. But, of course, that was mistaken. And so at that point, there were even then reasons for concern, because this technology, let's remember, it comes out of the military. It comes out of basically World War II and the development of radar and sonar and all of those kinds of technologies that the military used for their largely for communications purposes. And then during the 50s and 60s with the nuclear arms race, those technologies became very important for targeting of nuclear weapons and guiding them through the heavens and so forth. So there has been concern about this for a long time within very closed circles of experts. Then in the 80s, the industry starts to roll this stuff out without government regulation. When it finally really hits the public level is in 1993. And at this point, it's still very early. There's only about 6 in 100 Americans at that point have a cell phone. So it's still a niche technology, but the industry sees a very booming future. However, some of those early customers and industry workers begin to contract cancers, and they some of them, I should say, some of them blame their cell phones for this, and some of them are so angry about it, and their spouse is dying from a brain cancer, that they file lawsuits. And one of those lawsuits came to the attention of Larry King, who at that point had a very big nightly talk show on national television, and he did a story, and the story went viral. And the next day, Congress is talking about doing investigations, and cell phone stocks begin to tank on Wall Street. And then is when the Cell Phone Industry's Trade Association swings into action. And they quickly call a news conference in Washington, and they say, look, there's really no problem here, but to prove that there's no problem, we, the cell phone industry, are going to fund our own research, and we're going to work with the government to make sure that it's a fair and honest job, and we're going to fund research to look into this and make sure that to verify what we already know to be true, which is that there's no danger.
So let me
that's where we pick up the story.
Right, and so who is George Carlo, C-A-R-L-O? Who is George Carlo?
George Carlo is the scientist, epidemiologist, who the Cell Phone Trade Association, Cell Phone Industry Trade Association, handpicks to run their $28 million study of the health effects here, which at that point was the largest, best-funded study on Earth of this. And George Carlo, who we interviewed many times for this Nation magazine piece, was a... He had done studies for other controversial industries, and he sort of admits that, the Trade Association probably saw him as, quote, an industry guy.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because, well, he had done studies for the chemical industry that said that dioxin, which, of course, is the chemical behind the Love Canal and Agent Orange scandals, he said that dioxin in small doses is not a problem. He had done studies for the breast implant industry that said that breast implants were not a health risk. And so with that track record, George Carlo looked like the kind of guy who would give the industry what it wanted. And so they hired him to do this massive five-year study that would both commission original scientific examinations of this stuff and review the ongoing scientific literature, including the studies being done overseas. And so that began in 1993, and mainly what you need to know there is that it didn't quite work out the way that the industry hoped. George Carlo, at the end of the 90s, basically said, wait a minute, these studies that we're commissioning and the other studies out there are showing that there are serious questions about cell phone radiation, and we've got to be honest about that and level with consumers. Well, that was not what the industry CEOs wanted to hear.
That is not what they were paying for, right?
No, and so we have the smoking gun memo of October 7, 1999. George Carlo wrote long, I think it's a four-page single-spaced letter to the CEO of AT&T and the CEOs of the other 32 largest companies in the cell phone industry, in which he reiterates that there's serious questions, and he talks about how he says, look, it's not definitive. This is still early in our research, but here's what we see, that there's definite indication that you can have brain tumors on the side of the head, that the cell phone user is holding the phone. We're seeing genetic damages, et cetera, et cetera. And he closes with something that I think is very significant, where he says, we need more research, but in the meantime, you as an industry need to do the right thing and tell consumers what the real situation is so that the consumers can decide for themselves how much of this unknown risk they wish to assume.
Mm-hmm.
But meanwhile, unfortunately, some of the industry members, some companies in other words, are telling the public repeatedly and incorrectly that there's no problem here, including for children. Including for children, to me, is the really relevant point there. So unpack that a little bit. The cell phone industry was told almost 20 years ago, your product could very well be giving kids cancer and genetic damage. And what did the industry do with that? From their own handpicked scientists, they were told this privately. And what did they do? they kept right on going. And publicly, they denied it. They besmirched the scientist's reputation. They said he was, full of nonsense, and basically mounted this huge campaign to basically obscure public understanding of this, even though their own scientists told them that this could be giving kids cancer. I mean, I don't know what circle of hell that belongs to, but it's pretty diabolical.
Yeah. And so what happened, so that was 1999. What happened in 2011 when the World Health Organization was preparing to render its judgment on how likely cell phones are to cause cancer?
Yeah, well, in between there, the industry had been engaged in what one industry internal memo that we got called wargaming the science. They were wargaming the science, and that means funding their own industry-funded science that was finding the information that finding the conclusions, rather, that they wanted. But in addition, they were attacking scientists like George Carlo, who were coming out with information that they didn't like. And finally, they were also putting their own people onto advisory boards at key organizations like the World Health Organization. I mean, the World Health Organization is kind of the gold standard internationally for what health risks are. And so the WHO had not at that point made a determination about cell phone risk, and they were looking into it in 2011. And as your question hints at, the industry saw that correctly, I think, as a very, very important development that they wanted to spin and control as much as they could. And so they gave a lot of money to the study. They therefore had the ability to put some of their own people on not the actual peer review, but on the advisory panels and the other scientific experts who advised these scientists making the final call. And so we talked to a number of those scientists and the scientists who were lobbied, and they said, you know, these organizations, or rather these industry scientists, they couldn't speak up during the meeting, but of course they could sit there and take notes, and then during the coffee breaks and at night, they would go and talk to the scientists and government officials and basically try to attack and tear down and otherwise discredit the arguments that had been made that day by the scientists who were pushing for greater regulation. And in the end, WHO decided that cell phones were, quote, a possible risk. Now, I need to quickly say that there's basically four rankings in WHO for cancer risk. One is the most definitive is the known cancer risk. That would be things like, you know, arsenic or benzene, things that are obviously open and shut cases. Then there is, so that's a category one. Category 2A is a probable risk. Category 2B is a possible risk. And then category 3 is essentially unknown. And cell phones had been at unknown. Some of the scientists in the WHO wanted to put it up to at least a probable. One scientist from Sweden, Lennart Hordell, was pushing for known, a category 1. But at the end of the day, partly because of this pressure from the industry representatives, WHO said that they would only go to possible. So it's a possible carcinogenic risk, which, again, now that is that what the industry wanted? No, they would have preferred nothing. But they were able to do enough damage control that they kept it, instead of being a probable or even a known risk, it's now just a possible risk. Now, I should add, though, that this year, WHO, we're told by sources, is likely to reconsider this, and they are going to look, WHO told us directly, that they were going to look very closely at that study that we talked about earlier in this interview by the U.S. National Toxicology Program, and they're going to be taking that into account as they make their new decision. And as I referenced, that study found, quote-unquote, clear evidence that cell phones cause cancer. So it'll be interesting to see, will WHO now go up to
probable
or even a known carcinogen? That would be an absolute earthquake within the cell phone industry.
And just while we're talking about the global situation in Britain, France, Israel, and so on, other nations, the governments treat this issue a little differently?
Much differently. It's quite interesting. In Britain, France, Israel, a number of other nations, the government has promulgated strong restrictions on cell phone use, especially for children. And they're looking at the same data that we've been discussing here. And they, in France in particular, the iPads are not in public school classrooms. And you're told, you know, don't give your kids a cell phone before the age of 12 or 14. Things that would be considered blasphemous here, I think, in the United States.
Okay, and one thing that's on the horizon that I want you to touch on very briefly is 5G. What is 5G? What should people know about it?
5G stands for fifth generation, and that's the next generation of wireless technology. And it's involved with something that people may have heard of, the Internet of Things. And this is the dream of the wireless industry, that we won't just have, in the future, smartphones. We'll have smart cars, smart homes, smart workplaces, and they will all communicate with one another at all times, 24/7. So that if you're leaving the office and you're driving home, your phone can send a message to your oven at home to turn on to 350 degrees so that it's ready to cook your dinner when you get home. And it can also send a message to the furnace to turn up the heat to 69 degrees.
It can run your bath.
You like, all of these things. Yep. And, you know, it gets pretty preposterous.
Yep.
At the cell phone industry trade show that Mark Dowie attended for The Nation magazine while reporting this story, he took a picture that we have in the article of a doll, of a baby, of a toddler, who's sitting there with naked except for a diaper. And at the front of the diaper, right there at the crotch, is a little transmitter. And that transmitter is part of the 5G Internet of Things, because that transmitter is supposed to inform the mom or dad, the caregiver in the next room, when the baby's diaper is wet and needs to be changed, as long as you don't mind a little zap of radiation going to your baby's crotch. So this is the vision of the cell phone industry. They think it's going to be provide faster connections, much more convenience, but here's the catch. There will have to be mini cell phone transmitters every 250 feet along city streets, suburban neighborhoods, because the particular radio waves that 5G uses cannot travel as far as the waves that are used in today's technology. And so you can't just have a cell phone tower every couple of miles. They won't reach. The waves won't reach. You've got to be every 250 feet. And these mini towers will be about the size of a pizza box, and they will be placed, if the industry gets its way, they'll be placed on you know, the sides of buildings, on street lamp poles, telephone poles, what have you, every 250 feet. And as a result of that, we will be bathed in, as one of our sources at the University of California, Berkeley, scientists said, you'll be bathed in, everyone will be bathed in a smog of radiation 24/7, even if you don't use cell phones.
That's right. That's what I think is so critical.
You will be surrounded by it.
That's what I think is so critical about this one. With the cell phone, you can say, use earbuds, use it infrequently, get off the phone quickly, don't let your kids use it until a certain age, you know, except in emergencies. But with this, with 5G, And with smart meters that are on houses for checking your utilities and so on, these things, we will be bathed in this radiation without a vote. We're very close to the end. What, besides reading the article, which they can find at The Nation online, and that's thenation.com, right?
Correct.
Yeah. What else should they do, learn, read, get active?
Yeah, I think, of course, start by reading that, and then there are various organizations that are working on this. There's a petition that a number of scientists are circulating calling for basically a moratorium on this technology until there's more data. There's a number of organizations working on that. The Environment Trust, I already mentioned, I think is very good.
Sorry, you just said the Environment Trust. Is it the Environment Health Trust?
Yes, I'm sorry. people should check out the Environment Health Trust, and there's a lot of links there to not only the ongoing research, but the other groups of activists who are working on these issues. And one of the key fights there is whether states and localities will be able to decide for themselves whether they allow these 5G pizza box pizza box transmitters to be every 250 feet in their neighborhoods. The industry says they have to allow it, but the state of California and other localities around the country are suing and saying, no way, we're going to decide for ourselves. So that's a fight worth having.
And what I would imagine, and I'm going to close it right here, is that this infrastructure addition of those boxes every 250 feet is billions and billions of dollars, I would imagine, which means this fight of whether it's going to happen and whether it's going to be taken advantage of and so on is a big one. And so, as you said, environmenthealthtrust.org, I would imagine, is a place to learn a great deal. The article, again, is How Big Wireless Made Us Think That Cell Phones Are Safe. It's by Mark Hertzgard and Mark Dowie, and you can find it at thenation.com. And your websites are markhertzgard.com, and that's H-E-R-T-S-G-A-A-R-D. You can learn about Mark's work over the years and all of his many books and journalism articles. And then again, as I say, thenation.com. Thank you, Mark Hertzgard, and keep up the good work.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net. TerrenceMcNally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive a weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 6 or 7, 8 articles relevant and timely, you can email me at TEMcNally, TEMcNally, at mac.com, or sign up at my site. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. You can find years of podcasts at my site. That's Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Robert Reich, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, etc. You can follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Mark Maxwell in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please tune in again and share this podcast widely.